Today on Off Mic, the pandemic has impacted movie theaters, concerts, and community theaters. It's forced some community theater groups to come up with creative ways to get their productions to the masses. We talked to one group that's doing just that. We also talked to the new owner of the iconic African-American magazine, Ebony, and the owner's connections to Northwest Indiana, and preventing violence before it happens. We talked to the organizer of one such program in the city of Gary. All this on Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente, reporter with WBEZ in Chicago. Well, as we mentioned, the pandemic has impacted movie theaters, concerts, and community theaters. Movies, for example, go straight to streaming services like HBO Max right on the first day of their release. So they've had to do things to get their productions to the masses. And it's no different for community theaters. They like to put on great shows locally, but the pandemic has also impacted how they get their productions out. And one of the groups that are doing just that, trying to do something a little different for the area, is the Tao Theater in Hammond, Indiana. And we talk now to Jeff Casey. He's on the line to talk to us a little bit about this issue and about their latest production. Jeff, welcome to Off Mic.
Thank you so much for having me.
No problem. Well, before we get into the Tao Theater's latest production, tell us a little bit about the Tao Theater, because I know it has had long history in Northwest Indiana.
Yeah, so we first opened our doors in 2003, and just want to correct you, we're named Toll Theater after Marcus Toll, the first mayor of Hammond, who also built the Toll Opera House on our site in 1903. So when we opened in 2003, we knew we were in a large landscape of community theaters in Northwest Indiana, because there's a robust community theater activity here. So we wanted to set ourselves apart by doing shows that maybe other theaters weren't doing, either because of content or because they weren't aware of them or they thought they would be too risky. So we sort of carved out our own niche in the landscape here in Northwest Indiana theater.
You know, I love Toll House cookies, so I should have known that instead of pronouncing it Tao. So I apologize. And I've known the Toll Theater for a long time. So tell us real quick about, you have a new production now called Daddy Long Legs. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we actually started production on Daddy Long Legs last year at this time. We held auditions in Chicago and here locally, which is what we do for all of our shows. And we had the first step of the process, which is a read-through. So the cast gathered for the first time with the music and vocal director and the lighting designer. And we sat down and we read through the show. And then the pandemic hit, so we had to cancel the show. We kept in contact with the creative team, including the cast members, because both of them were just so perfectly suited for the roles of Jerusha and Jervis. And throughout the summer and fall, we reached back out to them and to see if there may be a way that we could make the show happen. So we felt, our board of directors and the staff here at the Toll felt, that we could make it happen safely as far as rehearsals go, because it's only two people in the show, and because the pit orchestra was really small, just a three-piece combo. So for those not familiar with our space, we have multiple entrances into our building. We have multiple restroom facilities. We have multiple stairways and hallways up to the theater. So everybody used separate entrances, separate sinks and stalls in the bathrooms. Everything was cleaned after each visit, of course. So we knew we could convene and rehearse safely. And we did just that, starting at the beginning of December. The cast came together. We started vocal rehearsal. The cast stood about 36 feet apart from one another with plexiglass vocal screens in front of them. Wow. And then on a triangular trajectory, our pianist sat about 18 feet from them. And then the staff, myself and our production assistant, we were about 25 feet away up into the theater seating. So it was a very safe environment. Everyone felt comfortable. And then in January, as we were approaching a potential live release of the show here at the theater in February, at the January board meeting, there was a great discussion about where we were, how safe we felt, where the country was moving. In January, a lot of the variants to the virus were just being discovered and better known. So we decided it would be better for everybody if we didn't launch live and we only went with an on-demand product, which is what we're going to do.
Well, Jeff, let me ask you this before we get into that. When you had to cancel your production last year because of the pandemic, how traumatic was that for the theater? And was it something where you first started off? Because I've done some local theater in Northwest Indiana as well, where we were also planning to do a production around that time. And we kept putting it off further and further and further. And it got to be so much like, should we even be hosting this? How tough was it for you? Did you put it off for a little bit and at some point just say, we can't do this?
It was devastating. When your entire business model is based on live performance, so all of your revenue or a huge portion of your revenue comes from ticket sales, and the body of your business, the heart of your business, is people coming into it to enjoy live performance. It was devastating for us, just like it was for all the local groups and as far wide, of course, as Broadway in Chicago. So it was a very tough decision. We early on, at first, we just, like everybody, we just suspended everything for 2 weeks. We were about ready to open with a youth ensemble production of 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. The kids were, like, we were in the final rehearsals. The kids were ready to go. We were ready to open. That show, we really thought, oh, we're just going to have to put everything on hold for 2 weeks, and we'll reconvene and go on with the show. Of course, that's not what happened. As soon as we knew we had to cancel Putnam County Spelling Bee and Daddy Long Legs, which was supposed to run in May, the board, and with the help of the city of Hammond, which is a huge supporter of the toll, it was just decided that we would cancel the whole season, which was, of course, a very difficult decision to make. Sure. At that time, we reached out to theaters operate kind of on two ticketing tracks. Many theaters rely predominantly on individual ticket sales to meet their ticket budget goals. Here at the Toll, we're really fortunate that we actually heavily rely on a subscription-based ticket. And there are pros and cons to both. But in our situation, what we had to do then, because our subscribers, nearly 600 of them, had purchased a four-show season package. At the time of the shutdown, we had only produced one of those four shows, Irma Bombeck's At Wit's End, which ran last February, and then the first weekend in March, right before the shutdown, we got in closing weekend. So we had to reach out to those subscribers and see, would they be willing to essentially donate or allow us to keep the portion of their season tickets that they never got to utilize? So that was the first step in navigating the financial crisis that COVID created.
Sure. Jeff, as the pandemic continued through the spring, then the summer, then the fall, what did you think was going to become of your community theater for the future? Did you think you could even open up again?
That is a great question. So we navigated the spring and the very beginning of summer very well, because we immediately accessed the PPP grant opportunity. So we were able to keep, because we have two full-time professional staff members here at the Toll. So we were able to keep both staff members employed. And then the PPP money ran out, and it didn't look like production was anywhere in our near future. So the board made the very difficult decision that the full-time staff would go on furlough, and which we did for 3 months, for June, July, and August. And during that time, specific to your question, the future of the Toll was very uncertain. We didn't know if the board and the city of Hammond could continue to maintain a staff for a facility that wasn't producing theater after the furlough period. the staff, myself, and our other full-time staff member, we had to start looking at if, you know, did we need to start looking for other work, which would be difficult because, of course, we would both want to stay within the industry, which was just as devastated as the toll was. So after the furlough part, so we were approaching the fourth quarter of last year, at the end of the summer, the staff and the board met and the city, and it was determined that the best option for everyone was to maintain the staff so that when the pandemic subsided, there would be people at the ready to reopen as though nothing had ever happened, pick up right where we left off with producing high-quality shows, engaging professional artists, and serving our community. So very, very lucky in this industry right now that in September, the staff was hired back full-time. It was decided that we would launch a fundraiser at that time to help cover the loss of all the ticket revenue that we had suffered from, and we set a very lofty goal of $50,000 as a goal to fundraise, which we felt was lofty because a lot of people were hurting, a lot of businesses were hurting, literally every not-for-profit in Northwest Indiana and the country and the world were asking people for money. So we just knew it was an uphill battle, but we were overwhelmed with the response. And as of February, we surpassed $53,000.
Wow.
So we're going to be good. The toll is here to stay, and we cannot wait till we can reopen.
Jeff, how important is community theater in Northwest Indiana, not just in Hammond and not just with your own theater? You know, I've come to, you know, just appreciate and just marvel at the level of talent in the smaller community theater groups in Hammond, in Lake County, Porter County. It's just amazing, the theater group that is the community that's here. How important is it to this area?
Oh, it's vital. It Northwest Indiana, in part, in my opinion, is defined by the incredible community theater artists and the community theaters all over Lake, Porter, and LaPorte counties. Northwest Indiana wouldn't be the same place if these theaters were to all go away, you know, and each one supports the other. You know, we all bring something to the theater landscape of Northwest Indiana, and each is equally important. It simply would not be the same place. You know, oftentimes Northwest Indiana gets bashed for quality of life or for this thing or that thing, but I think that community theater, the arts in general, is one of the things that counters all of that negativity. Not only does it give a lot of, like you said, very talented people an outlet for their creativity and for their talent, but the hundreds and thousands of people who enjoy community theater every year in Northwest Indiana, it's so important.
Tell us again a little bit more about your latest production, Daddy Long Legs.
Yeah, so it's a beautiful, it's categorized as a chamber musical, and really what that means is just kind of intimate storytelling with a small orchestra. It almost has an operetta feel, only in not music style, but in storytelling style. So there's lots of lush underscoring as the scenes are playing out. As I mentioned, it's only two cast members. It's based on the book of the same title, Daddy Long Legs, and then there was a film made in the late 60s or early 70s, starring Fred Astaire as Jervis, as Daddy Longlegs. But the film, it's the same basic story, but it takes a very different angle and perspective. The musical is a little truer to the book, I think. So it's about a young, wealthy New Yorker who is the trustee of an orphanage, and he often is the benefactor for the orphans to be able to continue their education at the college. Up until this moment in time, he had only ever supported young men going to college. But he finds this young woman in the orphanage, her name's Jerusha, who he feels just has a flair for writing and creativity, and he wants to send her to college so that she can explore her talent and creativity. So he does so through a letter. He submits a letter to the orphanage and tells Jerusha in this letter that he wants to send her to college and what his plan is. One of the caveats or one of the details of the plan is that they will never meet face to face. And indeed, he doesn't want her to know who he really is. So he gives her the pen name John Smith. And during her first letter to him, she kind of gives him a jab for picking such an uncreative name. And she tries to think of what she could call him that would be more creative and more endearing. And she remembers the first time she saw him, while she didn't meet him or see his face, his shadow was cast on a wall by his headlights of his car, and it reminded her of a Daddy Long Legs spider. So that's where the title of the show comes, and that's where her name of affection, her nickname, comes from. So basically what happens is the two people start writing letters back and forth, and as a result, they fall in love with each other.
Wow.
So it's kind of a simple, you know, boy meets girl love story, just in a unique way. The other unique detail is she assumes he's old because he's rich.
Oh.
Because it's set in the early 1900s. So the show takes place like between 1909 and 1912. So she just makes this assumption because he's a trustee of an orphanage, because he sends people to college, because he has a lot of money and lives in New York, that he's old, where in fact he's not. He's rather young and attractive, as is she. So I don't want to give too much of the story away, but they do end up meeting. They do end up meeting a few times. He's under another name, so she doesn't know that it's Daddy Longlegs. And the love affair kind of flourishes and continues. So it's a beautiful story. These two performers are incredible vocalists. The music is just so beautiful. I really think the audience, even though they're seeing live theater in a different way, it's being presented on demand, I think they'll get the sense of how beautiful the story is and how amazing these performers are.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I mean, a lot of places are having to do things different now. You're doing this production, not necessarily in front of a live audience, but on demand where people can watch it at home.
Yeah. They can watch it on their phone, on their iPad, on their computer. You know, these days with smart TVs, you can just log into YouTube on your television. People can watch it from anywhere. So we're hoping because of that, you know, we're in Hammond, Indiana. So to a certain degree, typically our audience base is defined by geographic location. It's people that are close enough to come and visit the theater. With this on-demand product, which is our first, we're hoping, well, we know for sure. Like, I have family members that live all over the country who have never seen a show that I've produced here.
Wow.
As the producer of the Toll Theater. So they'll be able to see something that I've worked on. Likewise, some of the two young actors who are both in their mid-20s, you know, they're fairly recently out of college. They have tons of college friends who, again, are scattered all over the country who otherwise would not be able to see this show. They'll be able to just log on and see the show.
So when is the show available and how do you see it?
Yeah, so the show becomes available on Monday, March 8th. And people will just visit our website, which is tolltheater.org, tolltheater.org. And then they'll find the Daddy Long Leg link on our homepage, and they'll just click and follow the prompts. It's actually a pretty simple process, even for those who aren't too tech savvy. And essentially what you're doing is you're purchasing a unique access code to watch the show on demand. So what that means is once you've purchased your code, which you can purchase as an individual for $21 or as a family or household for $45 or as an angel for $90. And once you purchase your unique access code, you will have 48 hours. Once you purchase it, you can wait to watch it till whenever you want.
Mm-hmm.
But once you start watching it, you will have 48 hours. And during that 48 hours, you can pause, stop, rewind. You can watch the show multiple times if you would like.
All right.
But But the fact that they're unique links is important because if you share that link with someone, hoping to get a break on tickets or whatever the case might be, then both viewing threads will immediately be shut down.
All right, Jeff. Jeff, thank you so much. Jeff Casey is the director of the Toll Theater in Hammond, Indiana, talking to us about his new production, their new production, Daddy Long Legs. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us here today on Off Mic.
Thank you for having me.
No problem. And we'll be back with more Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Well, Ebony Magazine is back. The iconic magazine about Black politics, fashion, and entertainment relaunched earlier this week as a digital-only publication. The last print edition came out 2 years ago. Publisher John Johnson started Ebony in Chicago almost 75 years ago, and its presence was a point of pride. Eden Bridgman-Sklenar is the new owner, and she's promised Ebony will reclaim its prominence. Sklenar's father is Ulysses Jr. Bridgman, who had a prolific career at East Chicago Washington High School, winning a state basketball title in 1971, undefeated, I may ask. And then when Mr. Bridgman went on to play in college, he also played in the NBA and opened a very successful franchise in fast food, and he is actually very successful. And he had his daughter, Eden Bridgman-Sklenar, running the new Ebony Magazine. I had a chance to catch up with Eden for WBEZ in Chicago, and here's a little bit more of our conversation. Ebony and Jet were founded here in Chicago with Johnson Publishing more than 75 years ago. And your reboot video on Ebony.com even shows it as a point of pride for the city, but of Black Chicagoans in particular. For fans who are now noticing the new website, what do you tell Chicago about why it's not housed here?
So I think that is a misconception that, you know, Ebony not being housed in Chicago. Ebony is Chicago. You know, it's the birthplace, obviously, where John Johnson and Johnson Publishing Company launched the brand. It's where we still want to have a presence. We understand the ties to Chicago, not just from the 75 years that the brand has been around, but the idea that Chicago is still absolutely an epicenter for culture. It's where talent is still coming out to this day. We want to hear the voices from Chicago, absolutely. So as we are moving into a new direction, yes, Atlanta obviously is going to be where we're going to have some new roots, but not taking away from Chicago. I think, you know, I lived in Chicago for a number of years. My husband's a born and raised Chicagoan. Our family has had business there previously to acquiring Ebony and Jet. So our ties are long and deep within the idea of being in Chicago. So I definitely want people to know that, you know, we're coming, we're going to bring you such amazing things, and we want to hear from you, Chicago. We want to engage with you in a new way, not just obviously resting on the fact that, you know, Ebony was started there.
Right, right. Well, in the video celebrating the reboot of Ebony.com, you say your mission is to lift Black lives. Let's talk about that mission.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, as we look at where Ebony and Jet sit at this point in time, coming out of the year 2020, where there was so much emphasis on, you know, the social injustice and where do we go from here, that we wanted to make sure that the new Ebony not just talks about culture, not just talks about entertainment and what people are doing on the, you know, red carpet to the basketball court or, you know, the amazing things like that, but that you're having real conversations, that we're providing not only information, but tools for our audience to be able to take that and implement into their own lives so that, yes, you are uplifting Black lives, not only talking about Black culture.
Well, Ebony's been out of content creation since the mid-2019. And you mentioned back in the summer of 2020, we had nationwide protests and a movement around Black voices and basically a new civil rights movement. How is Ebony entering that discussion after being out during the start of that?
I think we obviously take a nod of what the previous, you know, time frame as far as where Ebony was able to show up through its history, understanding its pivotal role through the civil rights movement of years ago. But then really our whole plan is to use technology to activate citizen journalism. The idea that we want to hear truly what's happening on the ground and for those voices to be the one that's driving the conversation more so than it being a top-down approach. So you'll see us introduce this whole platform on citizen journalism so that those voices can be heard and that we're able to have necessary conversations, the hard conversations that are needed in order for us to find the necessary solutions to move forward together, not just as a unit within the Black community, but also as a broader community. Because we know Ebony and Jet, it's not just for the Black community. We understand that our history is woven into the entire American fabric. So the idea that it's just going to speak to one audience, no, we obviously want to uplift a certain audience in certain culture and community, but understanding that it is meant for all to be able to understand the issues of the day and how do we move forward.
Eden, who do you want to read the new Ebony and who should be reading it?
I think everyone should. You know, the idea that Ebony is just for one individual is absolutely not what we want it to be. We want to celebrate the African-American experience. We want to give voice to what does it mean to have a platform that is for you, by you, and led, you know, by someone that looks like you. But the idea that it should only be an entity where Black individuals go to, I think that absolutely speaks against what this new leadership wants. That if you want to understand culture, and we understand that, you know, our culture is what drives so much. Our culture is pop culture. So the idea that if you're wanting to understand the latest trends, I mean, look at the inauguration. One of the most trending topics was not necessarily about all the different speeches and everything, but it was about Kamala's nephew, what he wore, those Dior Jordan shoes.
That's right.
That's the type of stuff that, again, reflects back to, it's not just about, you know, Black people kind of tuning into Ebony, but everyone. Everyone wanted to know, how in the world do I get those shoes from watching the inauguration? And we are going to be that platform to make sure, you know, how do you get them? Why they're important for everyone to be able to wear them.
You know, leading up to bankruptcy, the brand had issues surrounding paying freelancers that had to go to court several times. Eden, you're the current owner, but how will the brand now overcome any stigma from the contributors?
You know, I can't change the past, obviously. And, you know, I can't speak to what the challenges were for the past leadership. You know, obviously taking a print magazine digitally, that is not easy to do by any means. So what I can say is that the difference, I would say, for where we're trying to position everything is the strength of my family's business. The fact that we are able to implement certain structures, foundational structures around this brand, because we've been in business for over 30 years, you know, in various different industries, being able to take, you know, new ventures, starting them from scratch and making them extremely profitable. So we're going to apply those same business acumen that we have learned through our portfolio here to Ebony to make sure that, you know, yes, we want to have our journalists and all the freelancers and everyone who is able to touch this brand to not only be paid, but paid equitably, you know, to understand that this is a new regime that wants to make this a home for all those creatives.
Well, Ebony is back as a digital-only magazine. How do you plan to sustain the brand without bringing in readers who may have been attached to the print edition, you know, like older people like me?
No, that's actually been the most fun, is hearing from people once the announcement was out, as far as how many individuals still own physical copies of Ebony magazines. I mean, boxes and boxes of Ebony magazines still stored in their house with such a sense of pride. So we understand that, yes, it's going to mainly be a digital platform, but the idea that you will never be able to get some sort of tangible item from Ebony is something that we are actively looking for, because we know, you know, the pride that individuals have of those covers through the years. We actually have a coffee table book coming out that celebrates the 75 years and all of those covers. So we're going to look for new ways in order to put a product out there that you can tangibly hold on to. And that's actually a great revenue stream that I think the brand hasn't necessarily been able to tap into, is the whole e-commerce. The idea, you know, that you can not only have the print magazine, but clothing to other beauty products and everything under the sun that allows you not only to engage with us online, but be able to rock some Ebony swag, you know, in your everyday life.
Well, Eden, let's talk about your competition. The Black community is making a lot of content right now, and you'll be competing directly with social media. There are even local digital news and cultural magazines created in the Black community. In Chicago, we have The Tribe, for example. How would you compete with them?
You know, I think that is one thing that we are trying to make sure we signal to everyone, that it's not a competition. So many times previously, before, it felt like you could only have one. The idea that John Johnson actually invested in Essence magazine, you know, he knew the power of making sure that not only was Ebony and Jet successful, but that others were successful. There is plenty of room for voices and for other platforms to be out there, and we will carve our own path in making sure also that we're investing in the community. We want to uplift, as we said, Black lives and make opportunities available for other entrepreneurs. So the idea that we're in competition is absolutely something that I would want to say we're not. We're all in this together. We all matter. And how do we make, you know, our voices heard in a way that they haven't been able to before?
Just so you know, I know a lot about your dad. A lot.
In what way?
Oh, my God. He doesn't know me, of course.
Amazing career.
And I'm actually from his hometown, and I graduated from his high school.
Oh, wow. A senator, East Washington.
Right. I grew up seeing his life-size photo in our gymnasium for my 4 years at the high school. Well, I know I'm on several Facebook pages, especially ones with East Chicago and Indiana Harbor, where your dad is from, and they're going to get a kick out of knowing you mentioned Indiana, and because I grew up on the other side of the Chicago state line, as it were. So good luck to you, and all the best to your father. Your father is such an iconic figure, just in high school basketball terms.
Oh my God. Undefeated team, state
right.
Champions, absolutely.
If he just did that alone, he would be a legend. And then he grew up to this huge business.
I will let him know. All this other stuff he didn't need to do, he could have just stopped right there.
He's amazing, amazing. And good luck to you. And I've seen some of your videos, and thank you so much, really. This has been a great honor for me.
No, thank you. The honor is mine.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Preventing violence before it happens, that's the idea behind an initiative in Gary called Gary for Life. Here to tell us more about this effort is the director of that program, Joy Holiday. Joy, welcome to Off Mic.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Oh, great. Thank you for being here. Well, tell us a little bit about Gary for Life. We understand that it's not a new initiative. It was started some years back. Tell us a little bit about it.
Sure. So this was started, it was an initiative that started in 2016, and it was through a partnership that Gary had with the Department of Justice. And so the idea was is that we are recognizing that there was this increase in violence, specifically around group or gang violence. And so within this partnership, we were able to really establish a relationship with David Kennedy, who is a criminologist, and he works with the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. And so throughout some of the research that he's been able to conduct, what he realized was that there is only a very small fraction of our communities that are committing violence, right? And so it was only about maybe 2 or 3%. So instead of focusing our efforts and oversaturating our neighborhoods with law enforcement or police, let's only focus our efforts, as far as law enforcement is concerned, only on that 2 or 3% that are committing the violence. And so the mayor at the time, she felt that this was something that was really beneficial for us as a city. And so we started implementing it. You know, one by one, we would implement another block of it. And so with David Kennedy's help, we've been able to create programming around this, specifically saying that law enforcement is not just the answer. We really are trying to focus our efforts as well around engaging citizens and helping to support or either create supportive networks around people that are most at risk for committing violence. So this is really what Gary for Life has been committed to for these years.
And what's been, how successful have you been? It does seem violence is one of those things that's always been the bane of not just Gary, but Northwest Indiana, where it may not be a lot of people doing it, but it has such an impact on what people think about the communities involved. So how has, so far with the program, how successful has it been?
You know, this time, definitely, you identify something. It ebbs and it flows. And regardless of how low that number is, the impact is felt by our neighborhoods and by our community, certainly. And so since that time that we started our steps or our initiative, throughout the years, it depends on what year it is. But most recently, you know, we've seen a decrease of amount of our gang violence, rather, at least by 13%. And so we do see those percentages go up and down. But certainly I put that percentage, or I put the numbers into words. And the word is that is one less event that we've had of violence, right? And so that's one less life that we've been able, you know, to prevent the city from experiencing or either the violent act. So we really try to just focus in on what the impact is for our families.
So tell us how it works. How does the program work? Do people come together to discuss things? How do you do it?
So we have partnerships. And so we have partnerships with many of our law enforcement agencies as well as our community support network. We have a partnership with Goodwill. And Goodwill does our outreach and our supportive services. And so when there is a violence that occurs in the city, we do a review every single week of all of our non-fatal shootings as well as our homicides. And we're establishing what type of intervention can we do at that point, because what we're trying to do is to stop any retaliation from going back and forth. Certainly, we have realized throughout our research as well that one event then kind of spirals outward and then it creates a back and forth. And so what we're trying to do with law enforcement and with the supportive networks that we have with other community organizations is to stop that from happening. Once we're able to identify who those individuals are, we put boots on the ground. You know, we go and we speak to them, we talk to them, we offer them services. If they are at a moment in their life where they are really looking to walk away and to turn back to, you know, creating more healthy situations for themselves, we stand in the gap with them, you know, as a city. And we connect them to those resources. I can't tell you how many times, you know, I have experienced individuals that might tell me, you know, Ms. Holiday, I'm ready to turn my life around. But certainly they don't understand or they don't know the scope of what does that entail. And so it's for us as a community, it's for us as an initiative to stand in the gap with them. And then we connect them to those services. We will help them get their driver's license. We can help them with job employment, job readiness skills. We even do life coaching with them through Goodwill. So we're really trying to put them in better situations where they can make healthy choices. And then that in turn creates a much safer community for all of us.
Joy, how do you balance this? I know you say law enforcement's also involved. How do you balance it in terms of when a situation happens and you're trying to reach out to people who are involved, but the police may want to talk to them to possibly prosecute them? How do you balance that? That very could be a very dicey situation.
That's totally separate. So there is a separation, and that's why the relationship that we have with Goodwill is so very important. When they're doing outreach and when they are extending those supportive services, that is separate from law enforcement. Mm-hmm. Certainly law enforcement has its job because there are consequences to this behavior. There's consequences for harming the community, but they are not in that position where it's kind of that gray area. So they're not looking to prosecute. They're not looking to step in the way of their investigation, but we are there to help individuals who are ready to turn their lives around. So there is complete separation between us offering them services and then what law enforcement does on that end.
How has the pandemic impacted your ability to do this project? So many things you have to like almost keep away from people and now Absolutely. Do a lot of things by Zoom. How has it impacted?
There has been a huge impact. You know, for a lot of people that are doing this work, very fortunate. With our relationship with the national network through David Kennedy, we're able to talk to a lot of sister agencies that are in our area that's doing the same work. And we kind of brainstormed with one another and how can we overcome the barrier that is there for us that COVID created. And so we have to get creative. You know, certainly we're dealing with communities that may not be technologically, you know, connected. And so how do we bridge that gap as well? And so we just made sure that we continue with the COVID guidelines as far as health. But we would have to go back to phone calls. You know, we would have to go back to, you know, trying to find individuals that may have connections to others, you know, to find out, you know, what necessarily was going on, you know, in the community or in our streets. And so it was really, you know, that old school social work that really had to come back into play. And definitely it was challenging. And thank goodness, you know, now that some of the restrictions are starting to lift, we're able to put those boots back on the ground and really start making more impact.
You got to think with the pandemic, with people, with businesses downsizing, people losing their jobs, just finances and personal issues just getting more, just terrible under the pandemic. It's got to create the stress level in the city go up even more. And that may have created an environment that may have led to more potential violence.
You know, in that vein, we have seen certainly, just as I was describing, the meeting that we have every week reviewing that violence. What I have noticed is that there's been more of an increase in interaction, unfortunately, on youth. And I attribute that to kids not being enrolled in school right now. It may be attributed to the fact that there is less extracurricular activities that are going on. That's where we started to see more of an increase. And so throughout this work, really what we have started to look at, although we're looking at intervention and intervening so much with the aspect of years of life, this is really a natural transition for us to start getting into more prevention efforts that we have. And I think the way that we have decided to address that is really doing more preventative work. And that is being more geared towards our youth. And so as we expand and as we increase, we're opening up a youth violence prevention office under Thrive. Thrive will be the name under Gears for Life. And it is acknowledging that we have to do more from creating better situations where our kids can prevent themselves, or either we can give them the tools to keep them in a more healthy and safe community.
Joe, how did you get into this type of line of work? It's not easy work, what you're doing, and possibly a little bit unsung hero in the city of Gary. Why is this important to you?
You know, I was born and raised in Gary, and I had an opportunity to start working with the city as an intern. I was in a graduate program at Indiana University. And when I had this opportunity, you know, and to actually give back and to give, you know, and to stay here, you know, it was recognizing that it was a need. And I often tell people, you know what, you don't grow up and say, hey, I'm going to be a youth violence prevention, you know, director. No, you don't. But what you do grow up and say is that I want to serve our community. And so that is really, really the way that I kind of walked into this. And I have a degree in criminal justice. And once identifying that need, you know, and I had an opportunity to really operate in this role, I felt that this was something that I could possibly add value to.
How can individuals who may or may not live in Gary assist the Gary for Life project?
You know what? I have so many, you say unsung heroes. We have so many unsung heroes of individuals who dedicate their time, who dedicate their expertise. There's always the need for counselors and therapists and people that that really serve in roles as mentors as well. Those are the people that really are the unsung heroes that really help Gary for Life function. And that is a way that I believe that we can never have enough volunteers. And so they are, if anyone is interested, definitely give me either a call or an email, and I can give my contact information as well, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's fine. Go ahead.
Sure. So anyone that's interested in volunteering with Gary for Life, definitely my number is 219-381-6610. And also welcome to email as well. That's Joy, J. Holiday, H-O-L-L-I-D-A-Y at Gary.gov.
And I hope I'm not putting you on the spot by my last question is, oftentimes because of my work takes me into Chicago or far outside of Northwest Indiana, people will ask, well, is Gary worth saving? And I'm not really sure how to answer that because there's always going to be good people there who are worth fighting for. How do you answer something like that? Because I'm sure you get it.
Very quick answer. Absolutely. It is absolutely worth saving. Our people are the reason why the city is worth saving. And it is in the process of rebuilding and growing. And many communities have experienced some of the same issues and some of the same challenges that Gary has. But I am a total and absolute believer that we are in a moment that we are rebuilding. And I am very, very hopeful for our future. And for that in and of itself, that is the reason why we are definitely, our city is in the process of being saved, actually.
Well, Joy Holiday heads the program Gary for Life in the city of Gary, Indiana. Joy, thank you so much for joining us here today on Off Mic.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity, Mike. You have a good one.
You have a good one, too. Thank you. And that is all the time we're going to have for this episode. I'd like to thank my guests and my producers, Jose Rodriguez and Andrea Doty, my student intern producer with Cayman College of St. Joseph, who set up the interview with the Toll Theater. You can hear this episode again as a podcast by going to lakeshorepublicradio.org. For me, Michael Puente, thank you for listening. Have a safe and joyous weekend. Thank you.